So are there any questions at this point about these three tools? I always feel like I've got a little game clock going, and it goes dunka 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 dunka. And I'm going to insert for a moment that this is part two of the July 2009 teleconference on helping ourselves. And if there aren't any questions,
Jan,
I'll go on with a few more tools. Yes.
While you were making your presentation, I was thinking, with regard to, I guess it's a certain level of awareness that I seem to have had recently. It's regard to, one of the things that focused it was the idea of in meditation to present yourself in a certain behavior or posture that might help you focus.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about the business of kneeling, which the posture of kneeling, as I was brought up to use when I was growing up, and
mm-hmm.
of course fell out of the use of it. But then I began to realize that what that kneeling actually meant or should mean is that there is an awareness of the need for total surrender to the higher self or to original source.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did that, I suddenly realized I really experienced a strong sense of resistance to the kneeling, and it seemed to me I was really resisting surrendering to a higher power. And and everything else that I resist during the day, like some of the things you mentioned, cleaning the house and doing this, that, and the other, that I resist and procrastinate and don't do it, and it seems to all come from that same sense of resistance to the higher power. I don't know if it's a lack of trust, but there's something real basic, seems to me, in that. Somewhat awareness.
Okay. Would you like me to play a bit with that to try to give that some context for you?
That would be good. I was trying to do that in my mind while you were giving those different points on your presentation,
uh-huh.
and uh-huh. if you could clear some of that up in the light
okay.
of that, that might help, or use as an example, whatever.
So I think that's a great example. Because it's not too exposing, it's not too personal, and I think it's very universal. Okay?
Okay.
So I think that using this as an example is a really great way to exemplify the principles. Okay? So as I play with them, I do understand that I may not be specific to you sometimes. In other words, when I talk about principles, I'm not working with you individually.
Right.
So I may mention things that aren't valid for you, but I think it's a great place to talk about different ways of working with this as an example. So I'm sure it will address some of your issues. I'm just trying to be very, very clear that this is not meant to be utterly personal to you.
Right.
But, make sense? Okay. So what I noticed is this. I noticed that in your example, that you have noticed a pattern. Okay? Now, the pattern, your pattern of feeling resistance to kneeling for religious purposes, of feeling resistance to chores that you need to accomplish, and those are the two that you mentioned.
Right.
You may be able to find many other examples of resistance. It is very important to find all those examples before you make any assumptions. Okay? And then, when you have an array of examples in front of you, both large and small, The next thing is to look openly at possibilities. Now, we're not built like that. What we do is we look at the array of possibilities and say, I know what that is. Okay? And that's fine. Put that down as possibility number one. Okay? But there are a large number of possibilities here. So I'm going to name some. Ultimately, yes, a lot of our spiritual work is about an uncertainty about surrendering to God. Okay? That's a big one. And that might be a factor in the process of kneeling on a spiritual level or supplicating ourselves on a spiritual level. But how interesting that you resist housework, because God doesn't normally demand housework as part of a spiritual program. So that tells me automatically that the issue is larger. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
What I'm doing is I'm going to the logic. Well, the first thing would be, I don't want to surrender to God. Well, that would fit one example very neatly. Doesn't fit the other example. So I would expand difficulty in surrendering to God to difficulty surrendering to authority. And I differentiate God from authority. Other people may not. So if you've got God and authority wrapped up tight in a package, it might be difficult to see the difference. But God didn't teach you to keep a clean house. Your parents did. Most of us learn that kind of thing from our parents. And if our parents don't do that, society does it. But what I'm building here is that there's pressure from other human beings from whom we want respect and with whom we wish to stay in connection with to behave in a certain way. So society tells us to wear clean clothes or we will suffer some consequences. And the consequences are we will be thought less of. We will be categorized as a bum. We will be categorized as a bad person. And so what I'm building here is within, I'm moving away from the religious authority down to the housework. In resisting housework, it may be about resisting the invisible power of society to dictate how we live our lives, even on the level of how clean our kitchen is. That's how big this whole thing can be. So noticing your resistance to housework is not a tiny thing. It's not a petty thing. It can be a huge area of exploration for you to look at. Now, you can do one of two things. You can keep going and keep a daily review and find the other 50,000 things that you missed. Or you can use the daily review to specialize and to find only, in order to limit your daily review, to situations where you interact with authority. And because you mentioned these two examples, this could be a very powerful exercise for you. And what you may be able to collect is a multitude of examples where every time authority is sensed in your life, you react in a certain way. Okay?
Right.
You
I kind of resist that because it seems so hard to do.
Well, what I'm saying is it's easier than you might think. And what I'm suggesting is that I'm pausing for a second and I'll tell you why. I want to be transparent here. As I said, I've got two people who are actually in the room listening and they're digging a little bit. And I think they're digging because they're resonating with this, okay? I think they're nodding their heads now. There's a lot of digging going on in this room because I've hit a nerve. Okay? A lot of people have resist authority. Okay? It's more universal than you may give it credit for. Just because we all line up and say yes at appropriate times does not mean we're happy about it. And what I teach in the work that I do, what I focus on, is where we may say yes in public, but personally we resent something, and we don't feel that there's a place to express our feelings. And so what happens is that resentment stays hidden, and it grows. And as it grows, it may eventually burst like a volcano in ways that we can't understand. Where'd that come from? Well, that may have come from decades of resentment that you bottled up, okay? So it's important to find these areas of resentment, not to judge them, just to find them. By finding areas of resentment, and by becoming aware of them, we can then work on understanding what is this all about. Now, I'm going to play a little bit. In the old days, okay, in the old days, there may not have been too many options. And that may have been why society seemed to have been more barbarous, more cruel, more black and white than society does today. What that means to me is that people weren't any different. But when there was no outlet for our resentment, when it would burst strongly, and it would harm others. Not only can individuals build up resentment, society can build up resentment. And when society's volcano explodes, wars can result. Society can target other countries. Societies can target members of their own group. In effect, class warfare can be fueled by resentment over other matters that was never able to be expressed. The work of finding our resentments can result in society as a whole being more generous, more kind, and less prone to black and white solutions. So, to get back to you as an individual, or to get back to an individual level, when you find areas where you resent authority, there may be specific things in your personal history where authority was misused against you. Now, that's universal. It's a common human experience that you experience unenlightened authority, absolute authority. You do this or else. And the experiences you had as a child in places where you were not given an option, and realistically, children don't have very many options. As adults, we do, but as children, we don't. So a child who is exposed to an authoritarian environment when they're small, that doesn't mean they don't resent it. It just means there's no place for that resentment to go except in acting out. As adults, that same pattern may exist, and it may be unconscious. So kids are better at saying, I hate my mother, I hate my father, I hate my school. But over time, we teach the child, you can't say that. And so the child may stop saying the obvious. And that resentment, instead of breathing and moving out and dissipating, goes underground. And it becomes unconscious when we hold our feelings back and don't express them. They sink down into our unconsciousness. They do not disappear just because we're not aware of them. So fast forward 40, 50 years into the future, and you've got a simmering pot of feelings that have not been allowed to be expressed, and now you're not even aware of them. But again, they're there. The work that I do with people is about, as simply as I can say it, it's about connecting the dots. What happens to adults is they start becoming aware that something's not right in their lives. And they become aware because they're acting out in ways that seem destructive to them, and they may not feel destructive. So in other words, people realize one day that they are mean. They're acting in a mean way, especially towards specific people. And yet, they're not sure they're mean people. In other words, I always am rude to the policeman. I don't think I'm a rude person, but you put me anywhere near a policeman and I become rude and aggressive. Why does that happen? The truth is, the policeman may be a place where the authority issues simply come together for you. But the authority issues are there. Let me give you another very mild example. You take a magnet and you drag it through the sand, and you wind up with all these furry iron filings. Where'd they come from? Well, we can't see the one or two when they're scattered among hundreds of thousands of grains of sand. But when you run the magnet through and it collects only the iron filings, I think they're iron filings, you become extremely aware of how much of that material was in the sand. What happens to us as we move along in life is we start getting these collections of iron filings, and we may not know where they've come from. Now, I know I'm getting a bit far afield here, okay? So let me go back to the individual example. Resentment of household chores can come from a lifetime of not feeling that your preferences were respected. It may come from a place where you bowed your head and agreed to do things the way other people wanted them done. Not everyone is neat. I know neat people don't like to hear that, okay? But you know what? Messy people don't like to hear that everybody's not messy. There's a spectrum of human behavior and comfort. And there are the people with the white gloves that check the dust on the top of the door. And there are people that say if you can walk through the room, that's good enough. But most of us don't feel free to explore the spectrum to find out what our own comfort zone is. So what I'm doing here is I'm building some ideas for why you might resent housework. And what I'm trying to do is show how something as simple as not wanting to do the dishes can actually be a place of a starting point for finding out about a variety of other resentments that are really actually huge and important to explore, that matter, that can teach us something about ourselves, that can teach us something about other people, and teach us about the interrelation we have between ourselves and others and society. And then, of course, there is what I laughingly refer to as the big guy, God, who has been presented to us as the ultimate authority. And I enjoy poking holes in that theory because I have problems with authority. So in my problems with authority, I challenge issues of authority. I challenge statements of authority. And what I have learned to do is to consider the possibility and explore the possibility that man created an image of God as an authority. That doesn't really match who God is. And so what I suggest is that I'm going to use the example of kneeling as a spiritual practice, as surrendering to God's authority. I dare to suggest that God did not invent this practice. Man invented this practice. And that true surrender to God's authority has nothing to do with kneeling in front of Him. But when we are required to go through a ritual invented by people who misuse authority, we can confuse the idea of surrendering to God with surrendering to mankind in its imperfection. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it makes sense. One of the things that I wanted to bring up is when you were talking about the example of the magnet and the iron filings, I suddenly realized that my resistance seems to be at the point of picking up a magnet or using a magnet even.
Okay. That makes sense to me, because if you have not been able to get clarity in your thinking, the idea of picking up a pair of spectacles to see more clearly is not a positive act for you. If in the past, every time you took a magnet and dragged it through, you got more authority issues brought to you, and instead of resolution or enlightenment, then that doesn't feel like a solution. Awareness can be used by others to control us. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So sometimes becoming aware makes you more vulnerable. And we intuitively resist that. What I am suggesting is that the spiritual practice that I practice is not about community work, okay?
Right.
It's about individual work. And we need to get over the places where we have been controlled by, irritated by, frustrated by community, and start focusing on us. Because if you cannot resolve your own resistance, then when we work in community, those resistances will unconsciously come into play. There is a reason why Pathwork emphasizes working on ourselves first. It is not because we are the most important. It's that how can you work on other issues if you aren't even aware of who you are and what you want and how you operate? Without that information, when you interact with others, you are being controlled by unconscious currents that you are not aware of. So this work is about finding out in private who you are, how you feel, and what's going on. So I can hear that you have resistance to that, and I am suggesting that there's a reason for it, that the reason for your resistance in finding these things out is in the past you may have found out in a group setting, or when other people find out what you're thinking about or considering, they may have tried to control or influence you. But you have complete control over your spiritual work. You don't have to do this in public. And you can choose people to counsel you or to be with of your own choosing. So once again, when we are children, we deal with our family and our family friends. We cannot get on the telephone and call somebody over in South America for help. We don't have those tools. Today, you have many, many options. And you can segregate your personal search, your personal spiritual practice from your community and your friends. You can go outside your current situation and explore in an area where you are not interfered with in your personal life. I don't know if that's clear. Does that make sense?
Well, I think so. If you could say it another way, it would be helpful.
Okay. What you said, Terry, was I'm not clear, and I accept that. That's fine. So let me give this another stab. Okay. If in your family, let's say you're sitting around with your mother and your father and your siblings, and you say, I don't like my family life, okay, you're going to get some reaction. You're going to get commentary. You're going to get their opinion, and you're going to get, to some degree, the fact that they're upset or anxious about your comment, okay? As a child, that's your situation. So any complaint about the family is going to probably happen within the family's earshot. However, today, as an adult, you could find a different group and you could begin to express and discuss your feelings about your family in an arena that does not link directly back to your family. You can explore, separate from your family, your feelings about your family. You can have privacy. Privacy is important. We have that in society. We have accepted rules about how certain court proceedings are private. Why? Because the court feels that they may not be understood by the general public and assumptions might be made. So they hold those proceedings to be private until the public has, until there's a place where the public needs to know or should know. Between a therapist and a client, there's a presumption of privacy. Why? Because the client's trying to work something out. And there's no particular reason why the public should know what they're working on. When you're with your doctor has a code of privacy. Because there's no particular reason, unless you have an infectious disease, why the world needs to know how your body is functioning. On a spiritual level, we have the right to privacy. And we may need to create that privacy. We may need to find a place that is not segregated from our regular life, but distinct from our regular life, so that we can ask questions, so that we can pursue conversation and explore without mixing up other people's feelings about it. Does that make more sense?
Mm-hmm.
So to some extent, how can you figure out what you feel if every time you open your mouth, somebody argues with you? Who's invested? And this is why sometimes we have never expressed our feelings. Because every time we expressed our feelings, it was around people who are invested in the argument or the situation. So sometimes it's useful to find a place to express our feelings that is distinct. So we can explore our feelings and then take our conclusions back. And yes, we do need to take our conclusions back to our society, to our family, to our relationship, and discuss them. But there's a place where we may not have felt free to ponder the situation if every time we opened our mouth, it was with somebody who was invested in the situation. Now, I can feel it's not completely clear, but it might be clear enough. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
You may not even have asked that question, and I'm asking if that helps. So there you go. So I thought that was a really good example because, let me recap. The two examples that you gave can be interpreted simplistically, but they may have a much wider meaning. The only way to know if the meaning is wider is to look around for more information. So if you took a daily review and you looked specifically for any example of how you interact with authority, you would get a clearer picture. You may need more detail to really understand what this is about. And on the level of understanding, you may need at some point to be able to delineate what might be true about God versus how man may have inserted himself in the practice of religion. It doesn't make religion wrong. It may mean that your protest is towards mankind rather than towards God. And once we get that, instead of saying, I won't surrender to God, what we might be able to say is, I wonder if there's a different way to surrender to God that I could be at peace with, that I could take pleasure in. But I need to differentiate that from the practices and rituals that I have grown up with. And what I am suggesting is, at that place, you have an and. So bringing back the concept from the lecture, Unity and Duality, if it's or, I have to surrender to God or I don't surrender to God. I have to kneel or I don't kneel. That's duality. When you can say, I would like to explore surrendering to God, and I am going to differentiate that from the religious practices that have been taught to me throughout my life. Now you're not saying one or the other. You're noticing a larger, broader context that is, quite honestly, more complex. And my experience of life is that it's complex, not simplistic. Simplicity is a signal to me personally that I may not be looking at all the factors. So one of the tools I use to discern duality is when people simply say, it's this way or it's that way. Well, there are very few situations that are that crisp and clean. So I usually suspect that there's some duality going on there when I hear there are only two choices and they are widely disparate. So again, you could use data review to explore and to find out a lot more subtlety about the issue that you're looking at. And keep in mind that this is not a three-day magic fix solution. A data review will not, it may change your life, it can very well change your life, but this is not a game that we play where we're done in a month. The questions that we're asking are deep questions, and they may go on for decades. The point is not to answer the questions, but to engage in the exploration. But if you're engaging in the exploration and you are finding out more about yourself and more about how you interact with others, and you are creating more positive moments in your life because there's less resentment and more understanding, I would broadly classify this as a good thing.
Seems like maybe and some of the resistance. Huh?
But go ahead.
I see some of the sense of resistance might have to be resisting the complexity and wanting simplicity.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, very much so. And sometimes in wanting simplicity, the subtext of that is I don't want to do the work. I don't want to look at complexity. I want an answer. I want an answer so I can go on. But in truth, there's a lack of respect there for who we are as spiritual beings. It's not that simple. It was never meant to be that simple. Why would it be that simple? But when complexity is frightening and we feel that we get lost in it, in effect, we reject complexity. That's a good example of dualistic thinking. Simplicity becomes life because it's easy and we're done. Complexity is death because I get lost in it. Well, that's not necessarily true. But when we cast complexity in a negative light. We create a force for simplicity that isn't realistic, that isn't organic. So I want to mention a few other things. In the teleconferences that I have presented, I chose lectures and topics that I felt people could continue to work on their own. In effect, I tried to choose lectures that are accessible, that are, I want to use the phrase easily understandable, but what I mean by that is this, that there are some very esoteric and complex ideas presented in patchwork lectures, and that's all lovely, but it takes a bit of understanding the basic concepts to get to those. So I didn't present those kinds of lectures. I tended to present lectures that focused on helping delineate ideas and thoughts to support the process of self-evaluation, self-analysis, so that when I went to do this, outline this teleconference, to some extent I could, I felt that I could go down the list of what the lectures that I've chosen over the past year and take selections from each. But that's kind of a top 20 hits kind of talk, and that doesn't really do anybody any good. So I decided to focus on Daily Review, the four levels of evolution, and unity and duality as examples of lectures that can help you start the process of self-evaluation. Knowing that there's so many places for people to go, and people are so very wonderfully individualistic, that there's no way for me to know specifically what tool might be the best tool for a specific person. However, there are a few others that are really great tools. One of them is the lecture on reason, will, and emotion, the three personality types. Again, as I said in the original teleconference, there is not an intention to tell someone you are a certain type. It is useful to see where people tend to think in certain kinds of patterns, with certain kinds of prejudices based on their preferences and their abilities. So the joke goes, if you're a nail, then you appreciate hammers. If you're a hammer, you're looking for a nail. If you are an emotion type, meaning that you need connection with people, it is perhaps easier to understand your life choices if you really get the awareness of that. That rational thinking is not my favorite activity. That being in charge does not make me feel good. But connection with others, oh, that's bliss. Then you can perhaps understand reasons for what you choose, the profession you choose, the types of friends you choose. But you can also understand, because people are not that simplistic, that you are also attracted to learning about these other two areas of human endeavor. Even if you're not overly fond of them, even if you're not terribly good at them, we are still curious. We still want to learn. From another perspective, if you're a will type, and power makes you happy. It makes you feel alive. It makes you feel in control. It makes you feel like you can really go out into the world and do something. It helps if you understand that other people aren't thinking that way. It helps to understand that this is a choice. It's a preference. That it's a style of being that has both pluses and minuses. And when you're interacting with others, it can be very useful to notice what their preferences are and to really honor them. So the lecture on reason, will, and emotion, which has five or six other major spin-offs, is a very, very useful way to begin to understand ourselves and others from a positive perspective. Another lecture that I find extremely useful to work with is Reason, Will, and Emotion is Lecture 43. Another lecture I find extremely useful to work with is Lecture 233, The Power of the Word. again, at its most simplistic, you can condense it to a joke version of the Freudian slip. That when someone says something, you say, aha, now you're saying the truth. You know, I caught you in saying the truth because you said something even though you want to take it back or you're embarrassed by it. There's truth in that. But it is also true that if we look at the words we use day to day, they contain more truth than we may realize. So that paying attention to the words people say instead of what interpretation you want to make to the words that they say is a very powerful reality check. So these are just examples of places in the passive lectures where you can, depending upon your interest, on your personality, on your talents and abilities, where you might consider starting to look or work on your own process of self-analysis and self-evaluation. So that's why I put this all under the umbrella of helping ourselves. And unless there are any other questions, I think I'm done.
Thanks, Jan.
You're done. You're very, very welcome.
Bye, honey.
Why did you talk about these topics? Thank you. Appreciate
thanks,
you being
Jan.
Here.
Bye.
You're very welcome.
I love you.
Thank you, y'all. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.